I couldn't say for sure, though. His face gave little away. As for me, I was very aware of our proximity and felt intoxicated by his body and scent. Damn. Why did fighting with him always increase my attraction to him? His smile returned as he tilted his head towards Sydney.
You were wrong. She really is the new general in town.
I smiled back, hoping he wasn't aware of my body's reaction to us standing so close. Maybe. But it's okay. You can still be colonel. He arched an eyebrow.
Oh, did you demote yourself? Colonel's right below general. What's that make you?
I reached into my pocket and triumphantly flashed the CRV keys I'd swiped when we'd come back inside. The driver, I said. Chapter 21. I didn't get to drive. General Sydney didn't either, much to her outrage, though Dimitri did some fast talking to explain why. It all started when Victor discovered his car was having engine trouble. He wasn't very happy about that. He'd made no accusations, but I think everyone there, even Sonia and Robert, could guess the malfunction wasn't coincidental. This meant we all had to pile in the CRV, which hadn't been designed to seat so many people, which was why Dimitri had come up with a creative seating plan. Of course, one of those seats turned out to be the cargo space in the back. It was good-sized, but when Sydney learned it was her seat, she accused Dimitri of adding insult to the injury of taking her keys. I wouldn't tell her so, but putting her back there was a sound choice. Dimitri's seating chart was configured to minimize threats inside the car. Dimitri drove, with Robert going shotgun, and me between Victor and Sonia in the back seat. This put a guardian in each row, separated the brothers, and kept the spirit users apart too. When I argued that he and I could switch spots and still maintain the same security, Dimitri pointed out that having me at the wheel wouldn't be safe if I had to suddenly flip to Lissa's mind. It was a fair point. As for Sydney, well, she was neither a threat nor a fighting force, so she got offloaded to the back. And speaking of dead weight, we have got to get rid of Victor and Robert now, I murmured to Dimitri, as we loaded the CRV with groceries and our meager luggage, further reducing Sydney's space, much to her outrage. They've done what we needed. Keeping them is dangerous. It's time to turn them over to the Guardians. The brothers wanted to continue on with us in order to find Lissa's sibling. We were letting them, but not out of generosity. We simply couldn't let them out of our sights yet.
Agreed, Dimitri said, frowning slightly. But there's no good way to do it. Not yet. We can't leave them tied up beside the road. I wouldn't put it past them to escape and hitchhike. We also can't turn them in ourselves, for obvious reasons.
I set a bag inside the car and leaned against the bumper. Sydney could turn them in? Dimitri nodded.
That's probably our best bet, but I don't want to part with her until we get to... Well, wherever we're going, we might need her help.
I sighed. And so we dragged them along.
Afraid so,
he said. He gave me a wary look.
You know, when they are in custody, there's a very good chance they'll have quite a story to tell the authorities about us.
Yeah. I'd been thinking about that too. I guess that's a problem for later. Gotta deal with the immediate problems first. To my surprise, Dimitri smiled at me. I would have expected some prudent, wise remark.
Well, that's always been our strategy, hasn't it?
He asked. I smiled in return, but it was short-lived once we hit the road. Mercifully, Victor wasn't his usual annoying, chatty self, which I suspected was because he was growing weak from lack of blood. Sonia and Robert had to be feeling the same way. This was going to be a problem if we didn't get a feeder soon. But I didn't know how we were going to pull that off. I had the impression Sydney hadn't realized any of this yet,
which was just as well. Being a human among a group of hungry vampires would certainly make me nervous. She was actually probably safer sequestered in the back from everyone else. Sonia's directions were vague and very need to know. She only gave us short-term information and often wouldn't warn about a turn until we were right on top of it. We had no idea where we were going or how long it would take. She scanned a map and then told Dimitri to go north on I-75. When we asked how long our trip would take, her response was,
"Not long. A few hours. Maybe more."
And with that mysterious explanation, she settled back in her seat and said no more. There was a haunted, pensive expression on her face, and I tried to imagine how she felt. Only a day ago, she'd been Strigoi. Was she still processing what had happened? Was she seeing the faces of her victims as Dimitri had? Was she tormenting herself with guilt? Did she want to become Strigoi again? I left her alone. Now wasn't the time for therapy. I settled back, preparing myself to be patient. A tingle of consciousness suddenly sparked in the bond, shifting my attention inward. Lyssa was awake. I blinked and looked at the dashboard clock. Afternoon for humans. The Moroi at court should have been long asleep by now. But no, something had awakened her. Two guardians stood at her door, faces impassive.
"You have to come with us,"
one of them said.
"It's time for the next test."
Astonishment filled Lyssa. She'd known the next test was coming soon, but hadn't heard any further details since returning from the endurance test. That trip had taken place during the Moroi night, too, but she'd at least had fair warning. Eddie stood nearby in her room, having replaced my mother as Lyssa's protection a few hours ago. Christian sat up in Lyssa's bed, yawning. They hadn't gotten hot and heavy, but Lyssa liked having him around. Snuggling with her boyfriend while Eddie was in the room didn't seem as weird to her as it did when my mom was there. I didn't blame her.
"Can I change?" Lyssa asked.
"Be quick,"
said the guardian. She grabbed the first outfit she could and hurried to the bathroom, feeling confused and nervous. When she came out, Christian had pulled on his jeans already and was reaching for his t-shirt. Eddie, meanwhile, was sizing up the guardians, and I could guess his thoughts because I would have shared the same ones. This wake-up call seemed official, but he didn't know these guardians and didn't totally trust them.
"Can I escort her?"
he asked.
"Only as far as the testing area,"
said the second guardian.
"What about me?"
asked Christian.
"Only as far as the testing area."
The guardian's answer surprised me, but then I realized it was probably common for monarch candidates to go to their tests with entourages, even unexpected tests in the middle of the night. Or maybe not so unexpected. The court's grounds were virtually deserted, but when her group reached their destination, a small out-of-the-way section of an old brick building, she had to pass several groups of Moroi lining the halls. Apparently, word had gotten out. Those gathered stepped aside respectfully. Some, probably advocates of other families, gave her scowls. But lots of other people smiled at her and called out about the dragon's return. A few even brushed their hands against her arms, as though taking luck or power from her. The crowd was much smaller than the one who'd greeted her after the first test. This eased her anxiety, but didn't shake her earlier resolve to take the tests seriously. The faces of the onlookers shone with awe and curiosity, wondering if she might be the next to rule them. A doorway at the end of the hall marked the conclusion of her journey. Neither Christian nor Eddie needed to be told that this was as far as they could go. Lyssa glanced at the two of them over her shoulder before following one of the guardians inside, taking comfort from her loved one's supportive faces. After the epic adventure of the first test, Lyssa expected something equally intimidating. What she found instead was an old Moroi woman sitting comfortably in a chair in a mostly empty room. Her hands were folded in her lap,
holding something wrapped in cloth. The woman hummed, seeming very content. And when I say old, I mean she was old. Maroi could live until their early 100s, and this woman had clearly crossed that mark. Her pale skin was a maze of wrinkles, and her gray hair was wispy and thin. She smiled when she saw Lissa and nodded toward an empty chair. A small table sat beside it with a glass pitcher of water. The guardians left the women alone. Lissa glanced around her surroundings. There were no other furnishings, though there was a plain door opposite the one she had come through. She sat down and then turned toward the old woman.
"Hello," said Lissa, trying to keep her voice strong. "I'm Vasilisa Dragomir."
The woman's small smile grew, showing her yellowed teeth. One of her fangs was missing.
"Always such manners in your family," she croaked. "Most people come in here and demand we get down to business. But I remember your grandfather. He was polite during his test as well."
"You knew my grandfather?" exclaimed Lissa. "He had died when she was very, very young." Then she picked up another meaning in the woman's words. "He ran for king?" The woman nodded.
"Passed all his tests. I think he would have won the election if he hadn't withdrawn at the last moment. After that, it was a coin's toss between Tatiana Ivashkov and Jacob Taras. Very close, that one. The Tarases still hold a grudge."
Lissa had never heard any of this.
"Why'd my grandfather withdraw?" "Because your brother had just been born. Frederick decided he needed to devote his energy to his fledgling family instead of a nation."
Lissa could understand this. How many Dragomirs were there back then? Her grandfather, her father, and Andre, and her mother, but only by marriage. Eric Dragomir hadn't had any brothers or sisters. Lissa knew little about her grandfather, but in his place, she decided that she too would have rather spent time with her son and grandson, instead of listening to the endless speeches Tatiana had had to deal with. Lissa's mind had wandered, and the old woman was watching her carefully.
"Is this the test?"
asked Lissa, once the silence had gone on too long.
"Is it like an interview?"
The old woman shook her head.
"No. It's this."
She unwrapped the object in her lap. It was a cup, a chalice, or a goblet. I'm not sure which, but it was beautiful, made of silver that seemed to glow with its own light. Blood-red rubies were scattered along the sides, glittering with each turn of the cup. The woman regarded it fondly.
"Over 1,000 years old. And it still gleams."
She took the pitcher and filled the chalice with water while Lissa and I processed the words. 1,000 years? I was no metal expert, but even I knew silver should have tarnished in that time. The woman held out the cup to Lissa.
"Drink from it. And when you want to stop, say stop."
Lissa reached for the cup, more confused than ever by the odd instructions. What was she supposed to stop? Drinking? As soon as her fingers touched the metal, she understood. Well, kind of. A tingle ran through her, one she knew well.
"This is charmed,"
she said. The old woman nodded.
"Infused with all four elements and a spell long since forgotten."
Charmed with spirit, too, thought Lissa. That, too, must have been forgotten, and it put her on edge. Elemental charms had different effects. Earth charms, like the tattoo she'd been given, were often tied with minor compulsion spells. The combination of all four in a stake or ward provided a unified blast of life that blocked the undead. But spirit? Well, she was quickly learning that spirit charms covered a wide range of unpredictable effects. The water no doubt activated the spell, but Lyssa had a feeling that spirit was going to be the key player. Even though it was the power that burned in her blood, it still scared her. The spell woven into this cup was complex, far beyond her skills, and she feared what it would do. The old woman stared unblinkingly. Lyssa hesitated only a moment more. She drank. The world faded away, then rematerialized into something completely different. She and I both recognized what this was. A spirit dream. She no longer stood in the plain room. She was outdoors, wind whipping her long hair in front of her face. She brushed it aside as best she could. Other people stood around her, all of them in black, and she soon recognized the court's church and graveyard. Lyssa herself wore black, along with a long wool coat to protect against the chill. They were gathered around a grave, and a priest stood near it, his robes of office offering the only color on that gray day. Lyssa took a few steps closer, trying to see whose name was on the tombstone. What she discovered shocked me more than her. Rosemarie Hathaway. My name was carved into the granite in regal, elaborate font. Below my name was the Star of Battle, signifying that I'd killed more Strigoi than could be counted. Go me. Beneath that were three lines of text in Russian, Romanian, and English. I didn't need the English translation to know what each line said because it was standard for a guardian's grave. Eternal service. The priest spoke customary funeral words, giving me the blessings of a religion I wasn't sure I believed in. That was the least weird thing here, however, seeing as I was watching my own funeral. When he finished, Alberta took his place. Lauding the deceased's achievements was also normal at a guardian's funeral, and Alberta had plenty to say about mine. Had I been there, I would have been moved to tears. She concluded by describing my last battle, how I'd died defending Lyssa. That actually didn't weird me out so much. I mean, don't get me wrong. Everything going on here was completely insane. But reasonably speaking, if I was actually watching my own funeral, it made sense that I would have died protecting her. Lyssa didn't share my feelings. The news was a slap in the face to her. She suddenly became aware of a horrible empty feeling in her chest, like part of her was gone. The bond only worked one way, yet Robert had sworn losing his bondmate had left him in agony. Lyssa understood it now, that terrible, lonely ache. She was missing something she'd never even known she'd had. Tears brimmed in her eyes. "This is a dream," she told herself. "That's all." But she'd never had a spirit dream like this. Her experiences had always been with Adrian, and the dreams had felt like telephone calls. When the mourners dispersed from the graveyard, Lyssa felt a hand touch her shoulder. "Christian." She threw herself gratefully into his arms, trying hard to hold back sobs. He felt real and solid, safe. "How did this happen?" she asked. "How could it have happened?" Christian released her, his crystal blue eyes more serious and sorrowful than I'd ever seen.
"You know how. Those Strigoi were trying to kill you. She sacrificed herself to save you."
Lyssa had no memory of this, but it didn't matter.
I can't believe this is happening."
That agonizing emptiness grew within her,
I have more bad news,
said Christian. She stared in astonishment.
How could this get any worse?
I'm leaving.
Leaving what? Court?
Yes. Leaving everything.
The sadness on his face grew.
Leaving you.
Her jaw nearly dropped.
What? What's wrong? What did I do?
Nothing.
He squeezed her hand and let it go.
I love you. I'll always love you. But you are who you are. You're the last Dragomir. There'll always be something taking you away. I'd just get in your way. You need to rebuild your family. I'm not the one you need.
Of course you are! You are the only one! The only one I want to build my future with!
You say that now, but just wait. There are better choices. You heard Adrian's joke, little Dragomirs. When you're ready for kids in a few years, you're going to need a bunch. The Dragomirs need to be solid again. And me? I'm not responsible enough to handle that.
You'd be a great father, she argued.
Yeah,
he scoffed.
And I'd be a big asset to you, too. The princess married to the guy from the Strigoi family.
I don't care about any of that, and you know it.
She clutched at his shirt, forcing him to look at her.
I love you. I want you to be part of my life. None of this makes sense. Are you scared? Is that it? Are you scared of the weight of my family name?
He averted his eyes.
Let's just say it's not an easy name to carry.
She shook him.
I don't believe you. You're not afraid of anything. You never back down.
I'm backing down now.
He gently removed himself from her.
I really do love you. That's why I'm doing this. It's for the best.
But you can't!
Lissa gestured toward my grave, but he was already walking away.
You can't! She's gone! If you're gone too, there'll be no one.
But Christian was gone, disappearing in the fog that hadn't been there minutes ago. Lissa was left with only my tombstone for company. And for the first time in her life, she was really and truly alone. She had felt alone when her family died, but I'd been her anchor, always at her back protecting her. When Christian had come along, he too had kept the loneliness away, filling her heart with love. But now we were both gone. Her family was gone. That hole inside threatened to consume her, and it was more than just the loss of the bond. Being alone is a terrible, terrible thing. There's no one to run to, no one to confide in, no one who cares what happens to you. She'd been alone in the woods, but that was nothing like this, nothing like it at all. Staring around, she wished she could go sink into my grave and end her torment. No, wait. She really could end it. Say, stop, the old woman had said. That was all it took to stop this pain. This was a spirit dream, right? True, it was more realistic and all-consuming than any she'd ever faced. But in the end, all dreamers woke up. One word, and this would become a fading nightmare. Staring around at the empty court, she almost said the word. But did she want to end things? She'd vowed to fight through these trials. Would she give up over a dream? A dream about being alone? It seemed like such a minor thing, but that cold truth hit her again. I've never been alone. She didn't know if she could carry on by herself, but then she realized that if this wasn't a dream, and dear God, did it feel real, there was no magic stop in real life. If she couldn't deal with loneliness in a dream, she never would be able to while waking. And as much as it scared her, she decided she would not back down from this. Something urged her toward the fog, and she walked toward it, alone. The fog should have led her into the church's garden. Instead, the world rematerialized and she found herself in a council session. It was an open one, with the Maroi audience watching. Unlike usual, Lissa didn't sit with the audience. She was at the council's table, with its 13 chairs. She sat in the Dragomir seat. The middle chair, the monarch's chair, was occupied by Ariana Zelsky. Definitely a dream, some wry part of her thought. She had a council spot, and Ariana was queen. Too good to be true. Like always, the council was in a heated debate, and the topic was familiar. The age decree. Some council members argued that it was immoral. Others argued that the Strigoi threat was too great. Desperate times called for desperate actions, those people said. Ariana peered down the table at Lissa.
What does the Dragomir family think?
Ariana was neither as kind as she'd been in the van, nor as hostile as Tatiana had been. Ariana was neutral, a queen running a council and gathering the information she needed. Every set of eyes in the room turned toward Lissa. For some reason, every coherent idea had fled out of her head. Her tongue felt thick in her mouth. What did she think? What was her opinion of the age decree? She desperately tried to dredge up an answer.
I think it's bad.
Lee Zelsky, who must have taken the family spot when Ariana became queen, snorted in disgust.
Can you elaborate, princess?
Lissa swallowed.
Lowering the guardian age isn't the way to protect us. We need to learn to protect ourselves, too.
Her words were met with more contempt and shock.
And pray tell,
said Howard Zeklos.
How do you plan to do that? What's your proposal? Mandatory training for all ages? Start a program in the schools?
Again, Lissa groped for words. What was the plan? She and Tasha had discussed it lots of times, strategizing this very issue of how to implement training. Tasha had practically pounded those details into her head in the hopes Lissa could make her voice heard. Here she was now, representing her family on the council, with the chance to change things and improve Maroi life. All she had to do was explain herself. So many were counting on her. So many waiting to hear the words she felt so passionately about. But what were they? Why couldn't Lissa remember? She must have taken too long to answer because Howard threw his hands up in disgust.
I knew it. We were idiots to let a little girl on this council. She has nothing useful to offer. The Dragomirs are gone. They've died with her, and we need to accept that.
They've died with her. The pressure of being the last of her line had weighed on Lissa since the moment a doctor had told her that her parents and brother had died. The last of a line that had empowered the Maroi and produced some of the greatest kings and queens. She'd vowed to herself over and over that she wouldn't disappoint that lineage, that she would see her family's pride restored. And now, it was all falling apart. Even Ariana, whom Lissa had considered a supporter, looked disappointed. The audience began to jeer, echoing the call of removing this tongue-tied child from the council. They yelled for her to leave. Then, worse still.
The dragon is dead! The dragon is dead!
Lissa almost tried again to make her speech, but then something made her look behind her. There, the 12 family seals hung on the wall. A man had appeared out of nowhere and was taking down the Dragomir's crest, with its dragon and Romanian inscription. Lissa's heart sank as the shouts in the room became louder and her humiliation grew. She rose, wanting to run out of there and hide from the disgrace. Instead, her feet took her to the wall with its seals. With more strength than she thought herself capable of possessing, she jerked the dragon seal away from the man.
No!
She yelled. She turned her gaze to the audience and held up the seal, challenging any of them to come take it from her or deny her her rightful place on the council.
This is mine! Do you hear me? This is mine!
She would never know if they heard because they disappeared. Just like the graveyard. Silence fell. She now sat in one of the medical examining rooms back at St. Vladimir's. The familiar details were oddly comforting. The sink with its orange hand soap, the neatly labeled cupboards and drawers, and even the informative health posters on the walls. Students, practice safe sex. Equally welcome was the school's resident physician, Dr. Olensky. The doctor wasn't alone. Standing around Lyssa, who sat on top of an examination bed, were a therapist named Deirdre and me. Seeing myself there was pretty wacky, but after the funeral, I was just starting to roll with all of this. A surprising mix of feelings raced through Lyssa, feelings out of her control. Happiness to see us, despair at life. Confusion, suspicion. She couldn't seem to get a hold of one emotion or thought. It was a very different feeling from the council, when she just hadn't been able to explain herself. Her mind had been orderly. She'd just lost track of her point. Here, there was nothing to keep track of. She was a mental mess.
"Do you understand?"
asked Dr. Olensky. Lyssa suspected the doctor had already asked this question.
"It's beyond what we can control. Medication no longer works."
"Believe me, we don't want you hurting yourself. But now that others are at risk, well, you understand why we have to take action."
This was Deirdre. I'd always thought of her as smug, particularly since her therapeutic method involved answering questions with questions. There was no sly humor now. Deirdre was deadly earnest. None of their words made sense to Lyssa, but the hurting yourself part triggered something in her. She looked down at her arms. They were bare and marred with cuts. The cuts she used to make when the pressure of spirit grew too great. They'd been her only outlet, a horrible type of release. Studying them now, Lyssa saw the cuts were bigger and deeper than before. The kinds of cuts that danced with suicide. She looked back up.
Who did I hurt? You don't remember?
Asked Dr. Olensky. Lyssa shook her head, looking desperately from face to face, seeking answers. Her gaze fell on me, and my face was as dark and somber as Deirdre's.
"It's okay, Lys," I said. "It's all going to be okay."
I wasn't surprised at that. Naturally, it was what I would say. I would always reassure Lyssa. I would always take care of her.
"It's not important,"
said Deirdre, voice soft and soothing.
"What's important is no one else ever gets hurt. You don't want to hurt anyone, do you?"
Of course Lyssa didn't, but her troubled mind shifted elsewhere.
"Don't talk to me like a child!"
The loudness of her voice filled the room.
"I didn't mean to,"
said Deirdre, the paradigm of patience.
"We just want to help you. We want you to be safe."
Paranoia rose to the forefront of Lyssa's emotions. Nowhere was safe. She was certain about that, but nothing else. Except maybe something about a dream. A dream. A dream.
"They'll be able to take care of you in Tarasov,"
explained Dr. Olensky.
"They'll make sure you're comfortable."
"Tarasov!" Lyssa and I spoke in unison. This other rose clenched her fists and glared. Again, a typical reaction for me.
She is not going to that place, growled Rose.
Do you think we want to do this?
Asked Deirdre. It was the first time I'd really seen her cool facade crumble.
We don't. But the spirit, what it's doing, we have no choice.
Images of our trip to Tarasov flashed through Lyssa's mind. The cold, cold corridors. The moans. The tiny cells. She remembered seeing the psychiatric ward. The section other spirit users were locked up in. Locked up in indefinitely.
No! She cried, jumping up from the table. Don't send me to Tarasov!
She looked around for escape. The women stood between her and the door. Lyssa couldn't run. What magic could she use? Surely there was something. Her mind touched spirit as she rifled for a spell. Other Rose grabbed a hold of her hand, likely because she'd felt the stirrings of spirit and wanted to stop Lyssa. There's another way, my alter ego told Deirdre and Dr. Olensky. I can pull it from her. I can pull it all from her like Anna did for St. Vladimir. I can take away the darkness and instability. Lyssa will be sane again. Everyone stared at me. Well, the other me.
But then it'll be in you, right?
Asked Dr. Olensky.
It won't disappear.
I don't care, I told them stubbornly. I'll go to Tarasov. Don't send her. I can do it as long as she needs me to.
Lyssa watched me, scarcely believing what she heard. Her chaotic thoughts turned joyous.
Yes! Escape!
She wouldn't go crazy. She wouldn't go to Tarasov. Then somewhere in the jumble of her memories...
Anna committed suicide, murmured Lyssa.
Her grasp on reality was still tenuous, but that sobering thought was enough to momentarily calm her racing mind.
She went crazy from helping St. Vladimir.
My other self refused to look at Lyssa. It's just a story. I'll take the darkness. Send me. Lyssa didn't know what to do or think. She didn't want to go to Tarasov. That prison gave her nightmares. And here I was, offering her escape. Offering to save her like I always did. Lyssa wanted that. She wanted to be saved. She didn't want to go insane like all the other spirit users. If she accepted my offer, she would be free. Yet, on the edge or not, she cared about me too much. I had made too many sacrifices for her. How could she let me do this? What kind of friend would she be to condemn me to that life? Tarasov scared Lyssa. A life in a cage scared Lyssa. But me facing that scared her even more. There was no good outcome here. She wished it would all just go away. Maybe if she just closed her eyes. Wait. She remembered again. The dream. She was in a spirit dream. All she had to do was wake up. Say, stop. It was easier this time. Saying that word was the simple way out, the perfect solution. No Tarasov for either of us, right? Then she felt a lightening of the pressure on her mind, a stilling of those chaotic feelings. Her eyes widened as she realized I had already started pulling away the darkness. Stop was forgotten.
No!
Spirit burned through her, and she threw up a wall in the bond, blocking me from her.
What are you doing?
My other self asked.
Saving you, said Lyssa. Saving myself.
She turned to Dr. Olensky and Deirdre.
I understand what you have to do. It's okay. Take me to Tarasov. Take me where I won't hurt anyone else.
Tarasov. A place where real nightmares walked the halls. She braced herself as the office faded away, ready for the next part of the dream. A cold, stone cell with chains on the walls and people wailing down the halls. But when the world put itself back together, there was no Tarasov. There was an empty room with an old woman and a silver chalice. Lyssa looked around. Her heart was racing, and her sense of time was off. The thing she'd seen had lasted an eternity. Yet, simultaneously, it felt like only a couple seconds had passed since she and the old woman had conversed.
What was that?
Asked Lyssa. Her mouth was dry and the water sounded good now, but the chalice was empty.
Your fear, said the old woman, eyes twinkling. All your fears laid out neatly in a row.
Lyssa placed the chalice on the table with shaking hands.
It was awful. It was spirit, but it wasn't anything I've seen before. It invaded my mind, rifling through it. It was so real. There were times I believed it was real.
But you didn't stop it.
Lyssa frowned, thinking of how close she had come.
No.
The old woman smiled and said nothing.
Am I done? Asked Lyssa, confused. Can I go?
The old woman nodded. Lyssa stood and glanced between the two doors, the one she'd entered through and the plain one in the back. Still in shock, Lyssa automatically turned toward the door she'd come through. She didn't really want to see those people lined up in the hall again, but swore she'd put on a good princess face. Besides, there'd only been a fraction here compared to the group who'd greeted her after the last test. Her steps were halted when the old woman spoke again and pointed toward the back of the room.
No, that's for those who fail. You go out this door.
Lyssa turned and approached the plain door. It looked like it led outdoors, which was probably just as well. Peace and quiet. She felt like she should say something to her companion but didn't know what. So, she simply turned the knob and stepped outside. Into a crowd cheering for the dragon. Chapter 22.
You're awfully happy.
I blinked and found Sonia staring at me. The CRV and smooth stretch of I-75 hummed around us, the outside revealing little except Midwestern plains and trees. Sonia didn't seem quite as creepy crazy as she had back at school or even at her house. Mostly, she still just seemed scattered and confused, which was to be expected. I hesitated before answering, but finally decided there was no reason to hold back. Lyssa passed her second monarch test.
Of course she did, said Victor.
He was staring out the window away from me. The tone of his voice suggested I'd just wasted his time by saying something that was a given.
Is she okay?
Asked Dimitri.
Injured?
Once that would have sparked jealousy in me. Now it was just a sign of our shared concern for Lyssa. She's fine, I said, wondering if that was entirely true. She wasn't physically injured, but after what she'd seen, well, that had to leave scars of a different type. The back door had been quite a surprise, too. When she'd seen a small crowd by the first door, she'd thought it meant only a few people were up that late to see the candidates. Nope. Turned out everyone was just waiting out back to see the victors. True to her promise, Lyssa hadn't let it faze her. She walked out with her head held high, smiling at her onlookers and fans as though she already owned the crown. I was growing sleepy, but Lyssa's triumph kept me smiling for a long time. There's something tiring about an endless unknown stretch of highway. Victor had closed his eyes and was leaning against the glass. I couldn't see Sydney when I twisted around to check on her, meaning she also had decided on a nap or was just lying down. I yawned, wondering if I dared risk sleeping. Dimitri had urged me to when we left Sonia's house, knowing that I could use more than the couple hours Sydney had given me. I tipped my head against the seat and closed my eyes, falling instantly asleep. The blackness of that sleep gave way to the feel of a spirit dream, and my heart leapt with both panic and joy. After living through Lyssa's test, spirit dreams suddenly had a sinister feel. At the same time, this might be a chance to see Adrian, and it was. Only we appeared somewhere entirely unexpected. Sonia's garden. I stared in wonder at the clear blue sky and the brilliant flowers, nearly overlooking Adrian in the process. He wore a dark green cashmere sweater that made him blend in. To me, he was more gorgeous than any of the garden's other wonders. Adrian! I ran to him and he lifted me easily, spinning me around. When he placed me back on my feet, he studied the garden and nodded in approval.
I should let you pick the place more often. You have good taste. Of course, since you're dating me, we already knew that.
What do you mean, pick the place? I asked, lacing my hands behind his neck. He shrugged.
When I reached out and sensed you were sleeping, I summoned the dream but didn't feel like thinking up a place. So, I left it to your subconscious.
Irritably, he plucked at the cashmere.
I'm not dressed for the occasion, though.
The sweater shimmered, soon replaced by a light gray t-shirt with an abstract design on the front.
Better?
Much. He grinned and kissed the top of my forehead.
I've missed you, little Dampier. You can spy on Lyssa and us all the time, but the best I get are these dreams. And honestly, I can't figure out what schedule you're on.
I realized that with my spying, I knew more about what had just happened at court than he did. Lyssa took her second test, I told him. Yep, his expression verified it. He had known about the test, probably because he'd been sleeping.
When?
Just now. It was a tough one, but she passed.
Much to her delight, no doubt. Still, that keeps buying us time to clear you and get you home. Not sure I'd want to come home if I were you, though.
He looked around the garden again.
West Virginia's a lot better than I thought.
I laughed. It's not West Virginia. Which isn't that bad, by the way. It's Sonia Karp's... I froze, unable to believe what I'd nearly said. I'd been so happy to see him, so at ease. I'd let myself screw up. Adrian's face grew very, very serious.
Did you say Sonia Karp?
Several options played out in my head. Lying was the easiest. I could claim this was some place I'd been a long time ago. Like maybe she'd taken us on a field trip to her house. That was pretty flimsy, though. Plus, I was guessing the look on my face screamed guilt. I'd been caught. A pretty lie wouldn't fool Adrian. Yes, I said finally.
Rose, Sonia Karp's a Strigoi.
Not anymore. Adrian sighed.
I knew you staying out of trouble was too good to be true. What happened?
Robert DeRue restored her.
Robert.
Adrian's lip curled in disdain. The two spirit users hadn't gotten along well.
And just because I feel like we're marching into full-fledged crazy territory, which means something coming from me, I'm going to take a guess that Victor Dashkov is also with you.
I nodded, wishing desperately then that someone would wake me up and get me away from Adrian's interrogation. Damn it! How could I have slipped up like this? Adrian released me and walked around in small circles.
Okay, so you, Belikov, the alchemist, Sonia Karp, Victor Dashkov, and Robert DeRue are all hanging out in West Virginia together?
No, I said.
No?
We're, not in West Virginia.
Rose!
Adrian halted his pacing and strode back over to me.
Where the hell are you, then? Your old man, Lyssa, everyone thinks you're safe and sound.
I am, I said haughtily. Just not in West Virginia.
Then where?
I can't tell you. I hated saying those words to him and seeing the look they elicited. Part of it's for safety. Part of it's because... Well, I don't actually know.
He caught hold of my hands. You can't do this. You can't run off on some crazy whim this time. Don't you get it? They'll kill you if they find you.
It's not a crazy whim. We're doing something important, something that's going to help all of us.
Something you can't tell me,
he guessed.
It's better if you're not involved, I said, squeezing his hands tightly. Better if you don't know the details.
And in the meantime, I can rest easy knowing you've got an elite team at your back.
Adrian, please, please just trust me. Trust that I've got a good reason, I begged.
He let go of my hands.
I believe you think you've got a good reason. I just can't imagine one that justifies you risking your life.
It's what I do, I said, surprised at how serious I sounded. Some things are worth it.
Pieces of static flickered across my vision, like TV reception going bad. The world started to fade.
What's going on?
I asked. He scowled.
Someone or something's waking me up. Probably my mom checking in for the 100th time.
I reached for him, but he was fading away.
Adrian, please don't tell anyone. Anyone!
I don't know if he heard my pleas or not, because the dream completely disappeared. I woke up in the car. My immediate reaction was to swear, but I didn't want to give away the idiotic thing I'd done. Glancing over, I nearly jumped out of my seat when I saw Sonia watching me intently.
You're having a spirit dream, she said.
How do you know?
Your aura.
I made a face.
Auras used to be cool, but now they're just starting to get annoying.
She laughed softly. The first time I'd heard her do so since being restored.
They're very informative, if you know how to read them. Were you with Vasilisa?
No, my boyfriend. He's a spirit user, too. Her eyes widened in surprise.
That's who you were with?
Yeah, why? What's wrong? She frowned, looking puzzled. A few moments later, she glanced up toward the front seat where Dimitri and Robert sat, and then studied me in a scrutinizing way that sent chills down my spine.
Nothing, she said. Nothing's wrong.
I had to scoff at that. Come on, it sure seemed like...
There!
Sonia abruptly turned from me, leaned forward and pointed.
Take that exit.
We were nearly past that exit, and Dimitri had to do some fancy maneuvering, kind of like in our escape back in Pennsylvania, to make it. The car jerked and lurched, and I heard Sydney yelp behind me.
A lethal warning next time would be helpful, Dimitri noted.
Sonia wasn't listening. Her gaze was totally fixated on the road we'd pulled off onto. We came to a red light, where I caught sight of a cheery sign. Welcome to Ann Arbor, Michigan. The spark of life I'd seen in her moments ago was gone. Sonia had returned to her tense, almost robotic self. Despite Sydney's clever negotiating, Sonia still seemed uncomfortable about this trip. She still felt guilty and traitorous.
Are we here? I asked eagerly. And how long were we on the road?
I'd hardly noticed the drive. I'd stayed awake for the first part of it, but the rest had been a blur of Lyssa and Adrian.
6 hours, said Dimitri.
Go left at that second light, said Sonia. Now right at the corner.
Tension built in the car. Everyone was awake now, and my heart raced as we pushed deeper and deeper into suburbia. Which house? Were we close? Was one of these it? It was a fast drive, but seemed to stretch forever. We all let out a collective breath when Sonia suddenly pointed.
There.
Dimitri pulled into the driveway of a cute brick house with a perfectly trimmed lawn.
Do you know if your relatives still live here?
I asked Sonia. She said nothing, and I realized we were back to promise territory. Lockdown mode. So much for progress.
I guess there's only one way to find out, I said, unbuckling my seatbelt. Same plan? Earlier, Dimitri and I had discussed who would go and who would stay behind if Sonya got us to the right place. Leaving the brothers behind was a no-brainer. The question had been who would guard them, and we decided Dimitri would while Sydney and I went with Sonya to meet her relatives, who were undoubtedly in for a shocking visit.
Same plan, agreed Dimitri. You go to the house. You look less threatening.
Hey, he smiled.
I said look.
But his reasoning made sense. Even at ease, there was something powerful and intimidating about Dimitri. Three women going up to the door would freak these people out less, especially if it turned out Sonya's relatives had moved. Hell, for all I knew, she'd purposely led us to the wrong house.
Be careful,
Dimitri said as we got out of the car. You too, I replied. That got me another smile, one a little warmer and deeper. The feelings that stirred in me flitted away as Sonya, Sydney, and I walked up the sidewalk. My chest tightened. This was it. Or was it? Were we about to reach the conclusion of our journey? Had we really found the last Dragomir against all odds? Or had I been played from the beginning? I wasn't the only one who was nervous. I could feel Sydney and Sonya crackling with tension, too. We reached the front step. I took a deep breath and rang the doorbell. Several seconds later, a man answered, and he was Maroi, a promising sign. He looked at each of our faces, no doubt wondering what a Maroi, a Dampier, and a human were doing at his door. It sounded like the start of a bad joke.
Can I help you?
He asked. I was suddenly at a loss. Our plan had covered the big stuff. Find Eric's mistress and love child. What we'd say once we actually got there wasn't so clear. I waited for one of my companions to speak up now, but there was no need. The Maroi man's head suddenly whipped my side as he did a double take.
Sonya? He gasped. Is that you?
Then I heard a young female voice behind him call. Hey, who's here? Someone squeezed in beside him, someone tall and slim, someone I knew. My breath caught as I stared at waves of unruly light brown hair and light green eyes, eyes that should have tipped me off a long time ago. I couldn't speak. Rose? Exclaimed Jill Mastrano. What are you doing here? Chapter 23 The few seconds of silence that followed seemed to stretch out to eternity. Everyone was confused, each for totally different reasons. Jill's initial surprise had been laced with excitement, but as she stared around from face to face, her smile faded and faded until she looked as bewildered as the rest of us.
What's going on? Asked a new voice. Moments later, Emily Mastrano appeared beside her daughter.
Emily glanced at me and Sydney with curiosity and then gasped when she saw the third member of our group.
Sonya?
Emily jerked Jill back. Her face filled with panic. Emily wasn't guardian fast, but I admired her responsiveness.
Emily?
Sonya's voice was very small, on the verge of cracking.
It's me. Really me.
Emily tried to tug the man inside as well, but stopped when she got a good look at Sonya. Like anyone else, Emily had to acknowledge the obvious. Sonya had no Strigoi features. Plus, she was out in broad daylight. Emily faltered and opened her mouth to speak, but her lips couldn't quite manage it. She finally turned to me.
Rose, what's going on?
I was surprised that she would regard me as an authority, both because we'd only met once and because I honestly wasn't sure what was going on either. It took me a few attempts to find my voice.
I think we should come inside.
Emily's gaze fell back on Sonya. Jill tried to push forward to see what all the drama was about, but Emily continued blocking the door, still not totally convinced it was safe. I couldn't blame her. At last, she gave a slow nod and stepped away to give us access. Sydney's eyes flicked toward the car, where Victor, Robert, and Dimitri were waiting.
"What about them?" she asked me.
I hesitated. I wanted Dimitri to be with me to drop the bombshell, but Emily might only be able to handle one thing at a time here. Maroy didn't have to run in royal circles to know who Victor Dashkov was or what he looked like. Our trip to Las Vegas had been proof of that. I shook my head at Sydney. They can wait. We settled into the family's living room and learned the guy who'd answered the door was Emily's husband, John Mastrano. Emily went through the motions of offering us beverages, like this was a perfectly ordinary visit. But the look on her face confirmed she was still in shock. She handed us glasses of water like a robot, her face so pale she might have been Strigoi. John rested his hand on Emily's once she sat down. He kept giving us wary looks, but for her, he was all affection and concern.
"What's going on?"
Emily's eyes were still dazed.
"I don't know. My cousin is here, but I don't understand how..."
She looked back and forth at me, Sydney, and Sonia.
"How is this possible?"
Her voice shook.
"It was Lissa, wasn't it?"
exclaimed Jill, who undoubtedly knew this relative's sordid history. She was understandably shocked and a little nervous, but excitement was beginning to stir.
"I heard what happened with Dimitri. It's true, isn't it? Lissa can heal Strigoi. She saved him. She saved..."
Jill turned toward Sonia, enthusiasm wavering a little. I wondered what kind of story she'd heard about Sonia.
"She saved you."
"Lissa didn't do it," I said. "Another, spirit user did." Jill's face lit up.
"Adrian?"
I'd forgotten about her crush on him. "No, someone else. It's not important," I added hastily. "Sonia is... well, she's Maroy again. Confused, though not quite herself." Sonia had been drinking in the sight of her cousin, but now turned to me with a wry, knowing smile.
"I can speak for myself, Rose."
"Sorry," I said. Emily turned to Sydney and frowned. They'd been introduced, but no more.
"Why are you here?"
Emily didn't have to say what she really meant. She wanted to know why a human was here.
"Are you a feeder?"
"No!"
exclaimed Sydney, jumping up from her spot beside me on the love seat. I had never seen her filled with such outrage and disgust.
"Say that again and I'll walk right out of here. I'm an alchemist."
She was met with blank stares, and I pulled Sydney back down. "Easy, girl. I don't think they know what alchemists are." Secretly, I was glad. When I'd first discovered the alchemists, I'd felt like I was the last person in the world to find out. It was nice to know others were out of the loop, too. Keeping things simple for now, I explained to Emily, "Sydney's been helping us." Tears brimmed in Emily's blue eyes as she turned back to her cousin. Emily Mastrano was one of the most stunning women I'd ever met. Even tears were beautiful on her.
"It's really you, isn't it? They brought you back to me. Oh, God."
Emily rose and walked over to hold her cousin in a deep embrace.
"I've missed you so much. I can't believe this."
I almost felt like crying, too, but sternly reminded myself that we had come with a mission. I knew how startling this all was. We had just turned the Mastrano family's world upside down. And I was about to complicate things even more. I hated to do it. I wished they could have the time they needed to adjust, to celebrate the miracle of having Sonia back. But the clock at court, and on my life, was ticking. "We brought her," I said at last. "But there's another reason we're here." I don't know what tone my voice conveyed, but Emily stiffened and stepped back from Sonia, sitting down beside her husband. Somehow in that moment, I think she knew why we were here. I could see in her eyes that she was afraid, as if she'd been dreading this type of visit for years, as if she'd imagined it 100 times. I pushed forward.
We know about Eric Dragomir.
No,
said Emily, her voice an odd mixture of harshness and desperateness. Her obstinate manner was remarkably similar to Sonia's initial refusal to aid us.
No, we are not doing this.
The instant I'd seen Jill, the instant I'd recognized those eyes, I'd known we had the right place. Emily's words, more importantly, her lack of a denial, confirmed it. We have to, I said. This is serious. Emily turned to Sonia.
You promised you wouldn't tell.
I didn't,
said Sonia, but her face wore its earlier doubt. She didn't, I said firmly, hoping to reassure them both.
It's hard to explain, but she kept her promise.